On Saturday, the Blue Jays had the most Canadian lineup in MLB history with Russell Martin, Michael Saunders, and Dalton Pompey in the starting lineup against the Rays. Welcome to the RotoWire Fantasy Baseball Podcast, powered by DraftKings.com, America's favorite one-day fantasy baseball site. Use the promo code DVR to get a free contest entry today with a first-time deposit on DraftKings. I'm Derek Van Riper, joined by Adam Wolf. You can find Adam on Twitter at WolfManTweets. It's the evening of April 27th. The year is 2015. If you listen to us on iTunes or Stitcher and can please rate and review the podcast, we would greatly appreciate that. I also want to pass along some prospect podcast related news. Those episodes go up every Thursday. There is a new feed finally available in iTunes. If you search RotoWire, it should begin to show up within the next 24 hours or so. It's the RotoWire Prospect Podcast with Clay Link and James Anderson. A lot of big news to cover, Adam, and as we feared over the weekend, Adam Wainwright's season is officially over due to a torn Achilles. He's got surgery coming up in the next few days. And this is actually a mailbag question to get us started. It's from Matthew via Twitter. Will the Cardinals bring up Marco Gonzalez to replace Wainwright, if not right away, ultimately to take over that spot in the rotation?
I think Gonzalez is probably going to be the long-term answer for the Cardinals, but right now he's dealing with a shoulder injury of his own, and it's going to prevent him from taking Wainwright's spot in the rotation this week. Sounds like the guy that they're leaning towards getting the call right now is Tim Cooney, one of their top prospects in an organization that's really flush with those types of arms. Personally, I don't know much about him, but I think you just have to kind of trust the organization as a whole and their ability to develop pitchers that, you know, Cooney might even be a good spot start option right away.
Yeah, Cooney is a left-hander, third-round pick of the Cardinals back in 2012 out of Wake Forest. The numbers in 2013 were outstanding. He had a 148-22 strikeout-to-walk ratio in 154 and a third innings. Last year, spending the entire season at AAA Memphis, strikeout rate came down. He had 119 Ks in 158 innings, 47 walks, so the control also took a step back. I think he's probably a number four starter in the long run. Maybe there's some long-term growth potential there, but he may be the leading candidate to get the first opportunity to step in for Wainwright this week because Marco Gonzalez is returning from a minor shoulder issue with Memphis right now. So I think long-term, Gonzalez is the play, but short-term, it may be Cooney, it may be one of the other mid-level prospects the Cardinals have. We'll have to keep a close eye on their rotation plans as the week progresses. But this is a team that really, I mean, for as much depth as they have, Wainwright's a tough guy to replace because he's a potential 5 to 6 win starter in a year where everything goes well. It's strange to me that the concern with him throughout the offseason was based on the cartilage he had removed from his elbow. I thought there were some problems with his arm potentially. I stayed away from him based on those concerns. But after a brief scare in spring training with a potential core muscle issue, Wainwright came back, and he actually looked really good prior to going down while hitting, no less, in Saturday's game. This is just another mark on the side of the ledger that points to needing a DH in the National League because you have so few frontline starters. I mean, pitching around the game seems better overall because offense is down. If one's down, the other is up, essentially. To me, there's no reason for guys like Wainwright and Kershaw and Matt Harvey and Max Scherzer to go to the plate and take a few hacks in a game.
Yeah, and certainly that Wainwright and Scherzer injuries will only increase the echo chamber of people that, you know, want a DH in place in the National League. And it's a valid point, you have to think, just because, you know, especially with the way that offense is deflated these days, I think that's probably one reason for the decline to a degree in baseball's popularity, that there's just not enough offense these days, you know, compared to the late 90s when people were hitting homers all the time. So even from an entertainment standpoint, just that alone, I think adding the DH would be beneficial. But if nothing else, you do want to, you know, protect your assets if you're investing millions of dollars into guys like Wainwright, too, for what they do on the mound.
Plenty of injuries to get to here on this Monday night. Brandon McCarthy has a torn UCL. He's going to be out until the beginning of the 2016 season. This time next year, you could probably say May of 2016 in the best case scenario. McCarthy has had a long list of injuries, many shoulder problems throughout his career, but this is actually his first Tommy John surgery that'll go down probably within the next few days. It leaves the Dodgers in a bad spot, and we have another mailbag question. This one is from Steve. Who are the starting pitchers to own with McCarthy down for the year and with Hyunjin Ryu still sidelined by a shoulder injury? We've already seen the Dodgers have kind of a revolving door situation with Ryu's spot. Now it's going to get worse, you know, with McCarthy out for the rest of the season.
And I think, like the Cardinals, this might be just a situation where you have a short-term play in place for McCarthy's absence. And I think right now they're going to go with Scott Baker. It seems like he's first in line to get McCarthy's spot in the rotation. But as you mentioned, Ryu is still a little bit off of a return as well, so that will open up another spot. Really a bevy of candidates for the Dodgers to choose from. None of them are overly enticing, but somebody like Joe Wieland, if he got a shot, I think that he would be pretty interesting. He's been, you know, ravaged by injuries of his own, even more so than McCarthy the last few seasons. But there was a time when he did hold some acclaim as a prospect in the Padres system and is getting off to a pretty nice start at AAA so far.
Yeah, he has pitched well, even though he's been in the PCL through three starts, 17 strikeouts, two walks, holding the opposition to an even three ERA so far, and a 207 batting average against. I think Wieland's calling card will be control. Just 25 years old, a former fourth rounder of the Rangers. He was included in a deal that sent Mike Adams to Texas a few years back, and then part of a swap this offseason between the Dodgers and Padres. So definitely keep tabs on Joe Wieland. Scott Baker got the opportunity first. It was believed to be Wieland initially when they were going to make a switch. So I think this is going to be a fluid situation. We saw Michael Bolsinger make a start last week. I would put him near the bottom of the list. I think he's more of a replacement level arm. The other name I think people are going to ask about is Zach Lee. I mean, this is a fallen prospect in many ways. If you look at where he was on lists a couple seasons ago versus now, it's a pretty big difference. But he's the kind of guy that, if he's been able to figure anything out at all, just make any sort of adjustments, he could become intriguing again. Last year at AAA Albuquerque, he had a 5.38 ERA and a 1.54 whip. But you go back to his 2013 season as a 21-year-old at AA, had a 3.22 ERA and a 1.17 whip. So I just wonder how much of his struggles last year were the result of being in such an extremely hitter-friendly environment. The start to begin this year has been much better with the Dodgers' new AAA affiliate in Oklahoma City.
Certainly didn't help his cause to be in Albuquerque last year, but really, like you said, turning it around at Oklahoma City, in addition to ERA below a run right now, he also has an 18-4 strikeout-to-walk ratio. Just three starts, so tough to make too much of that kind of sample, but really good to see Zach Lee at least kind of regain the control that he lacked a little bit last year and really up the strikeouts, which kind of contributed to his decline in 2014.
Yeah, I just want to know, is there anything that's changed skills-wise with him? Maybe the control has just improved. Again, four walks through 19 innings. That jumps off the page as something that is significantly better than previous years. He has flashed the ability to miss bats at times, so keep Zach Lee's name in mind as the Dodgers continue to scramble. I think Wieland might be first. Lee might be second if you look at the prospects. Julio Urias could be an option at some point. I mean, you talk about a guy that gets lots of buzz. The age-to-level performance for Urias has been excellent. I think the Dodgers already ruled him out as an option for the initial call-up, but maybe in the second half of this year, we could see him debut possibly as an 18-year-old at the big league level.
Basically, what he's doing is the equivalent of a high school guy immediately having success at the AA level. He's only 18 years old and, you know, already dominating at AA Tulsa. Just looking at his numbers tonight, he actually just allowed one hit over six innings, struck out 10 guys, just to lower that ERA to 2.18 so far at AA Tulsa. And I know, as tempting as it might be to, you know, throw him in the rotation right away, I think the Dodgers do want him to get some more development time. Really could have a Jose Fernandez type of effect. I think he's in that caliber as a prospect, but I don't think the Dodgers are you know, motivated to get him up in the big leagues right now.
Yeah, they just seem like they don't want to put too much on their young lefty too soon. If you look back at some of the prospect lists, Baseball America had him top 10 going into the season, top 10 overall. MLB.com had him at number 8. Baseball Prospectus had him at 10. I know our lists at RotoWire had him pretty high up as well. So Julio Urias, definitely a guy that could get a look in the second half, but the Dodgers have already ruled out the possibility of him getting the first call as they try to move on without Brandon McCarthy. This news kind of flashed by out of the blue, too. Homer Bailey is back on the DL. He's got an elbow ligament sprain, and this is after he had flexor tendon surgery in the offseason. Further tests seem like a lock at this point. Where do the Reds go for depth? I mean, they're already leaning on Jason Marquis as a starter every fifth day. Is there anybody at all that you like in this organization who could possibly jump in? Because, Tony Cingrani's not even stretched out right now. He's barely being used as a mop-up reliever, so you wouldn't think he'd get the call. But if he'd at least been pitching three innings at a time, he could have gotten stretched out and taken the ball every fifth day just for the short term.
It sounds like the names that the Reds are considering right now are two of their better prospects, Raisel Iglesias, who got a lot of buzz out of spring training but ultimately was demoted to the minors. Mike Lorenzen, another name that will probably come up. I'm not sure if those guys are going to have immediate success if they are indeed called upon to fill in for Homer Bailey. But, just by virtue of having pretty good prospect status, I think they are more interesting than, the typical fifth starter that might fill in for Bailey.
Yeah, we'll see if the further tests that we're expecting happen in the next couple days for Bailey. The Reds, of course, at least Brian Price, playing a little more close to the vest lately after the blow-up last week. The Rockies have placed Adam Ottavino on the 15-day DL with right triceps inflammation. Speculation here is that John Axford's going to be the closer. I think we even saw a note from Nick Groeke from the Denver Post suggesting as much. Could it be a committee, though? Could it be Axford with Rafael Betancourt, Adam?
The Rockies haven't dismissed Betancourt as out of the mix just yet, so you do have to kind of monitor the situation still. It sounded like what manager Walt Weiss said was that Axford was going to get any save opportunity that came about on Monday, and I'm really not of mind that Betancourt is going to be much of a factor in this conversation. He's over 40 years old, and I think the save that you saw him get earlier in the year was kind of just a cookie to give an old standby just for working his way back from Tommy John surgery, really kind of an improbable development. But I think Betancourt kind of profiles as a middle innings guy, whereas Axford, he had his struggles the last few years. He's bounced around a lot of organizations, but I think the light kind of came on for him when he was in Cleveland last year. He generated ground balls at a really nice rate, above 50%. Has continued that trend so far this year and, still throws in the mid-90s.
Yeah, I think there's a lot to like there just in terms of the raw talent. The Rockies have a surprising amount of bullpen depth. I think they get a bad rap, maybe a better bullpen than they get credit for, at least. We'll see what happens with Ottavino if this triceps inflammation turns into anything at all, like the injury that's sidelining Justin Verlander right now. That's the first person I think of right now when we're talking triceps, because he has not made really any progress since hitting the DL, had a setback, and really has been stuck in a holding pattern ever since. As we alluded to earlier, Max Scherzer still banged up, dealing with a thumb injury. He will not take the ball as planned on Tuesday. AJ Cole and Tanner Roark are the options to start in his place. Cole might make more sense because Roark's been working as a reliever for the Nats, so if they'd want to preserve the bullpen a little bit, a spot start for Cole may be in order. But again, this is just another example of why you really don't want pitchers hitting in the National League. I don't know if that's a rule change that's only an off season away from happening or if it's going to take longer. But if Cole makes a spot start, are you picking him up for leagues that allow daily moves?
I think so. He's had pretty good success everywhere that he's been in the minors. And if you're in a deeper league, it makes sense if you have the option to stream guys with daily moves, it does make sense to take a flyer on him. I'm not really blowing my fab budget because it doesn't sound like Scherzer is due to miss a lot of time. This might even be the only start that he misses. So those with daily lineup moves would be the only area where I'd be targeting Cole heavily.
And I think with AJ Cole, you look at the options they have, they could easily stretch out Roark if they were going to miss a starter for a prolonged stretch. So they don't have to use him as that sixth starter. I think he's really truly the seventh guy on the depth chart right now. Numbers last year were pretty solid. I think he split time between AA Harrisburg and AAA Syracuse, pitched to a 3.16 ERA between the two levels, 111 strikeouts in 134 innings, 32 walks. Did get knocked around a little bit, especially really at both spots, but kind of surprisingly at AA, 79 hits in 71 innings. So the whip might be the category where there's some concern, but the Nationals are kind of in a bad way right now. We'll break that down a little bit later as we look at the Monday night box scores. As another Nats-related item, Anthony Rendon was scratched from the lineup at AA Harrisburg on Monday due to fatigue. I avoided drafting him even at pretty significantly discounted prices as draft season unfolded. Maybe this is just minor, but it's only going to add to the concern that I have that once he comes back, he's going to need some days off, and he may not run much, as a decent amount of his value came last year from his ability to steal bases. He had 17 steals last year, which seemed to come out of relative nowhere.
Yeah, I'm with you. Anytime a player enters the season with an injury, I kind of just assume the worst case scenario, just so you're not, you know, caught in a rough situation. Unless you, you know, have the bench spots available where you can handle that absence for a long term. But probably taking a little bit longer than I think a lot of people expected for Rendon right now. Fortunately, it doesn't seem like it's related to the knee. So that's fortunate in that regard. But just anything that involves a setback of any nature is obviously something that you don't like to see right here. And I'm with you. I think it's a very real concern that the steals might not come back once he gets back in the lineup.
Still got a pretty lengthy list of injuries to go through here. Ryan Braun sitting again Monday, and apparently he's not hurt. Got the day off Sunday. Also out of the lineup against the Reds. And he usually owns Jason Marquis, who actually started the game for Cincinnati on Monday, but Braun did not start this game. Seems out of sync, at least that's what he's saying. He's having some trouble with his mechanics after dealing with that thumb injury last season. But isn't that what spring training is for? Isn't that the time where you're supposed to iron out those mechanics, get those reps that you need so you get into April and everything's good to go?
Yeah, you'd think that he'd be back in the lineup as the de facto star of this team, that he'd, you know, take that place back in the outfield. But I think it just speaks to the Brewers' desperation a little bit that he was held out of the lineup for the second straight day. The Brewers actually got a win with a lot of spare parts on Sunday, and maybe manager Ron Renick, he's just trying to keep the momentum going. Didn't look like it continued tonight. We'll probably review that box score later, but you can't really worry too much about Braun just yet with no injury being cited here. But everything else that he's shown thus far suggests that his value isn't likely to go up anytime soon.
Yeah, it seems like the approach is broken at the current time. We'll see if it's fixable. At least for now, no injury being reported for Ryan Braun. Hisashi Iwakuma has been able to do some strength exercises and some light throwing. He's expected to miss 2 to 4 weeks after being diagnosed with a grade 1 strain of the lat muscle on his right side. So very good sign that he's already throwing, could be back mid to late May, even if that takes the longer end of the 2 to 4 week timetable. Iwakuma going to be replaced by Roenis Elias in the short term. Elias gets the Astros on the road in his first start on Friday. What do you think about Elias as a short-term pickup or even just a streaming option for this week against a team that has a ton of swing and miss in its lineup?
I do think he's a great streaming option for those reasons you mentioned, just because of the strikeout potential that exists there. I don't know if I like him as much as some of the other replacement options that we alluded to with all the other teams that are dealing with injuries, but Elias might have more longevity than the rest of those guys just because we know that Iwakuma is going to be forced to miss a few weeks because of those injuries. So if you can count on him for 2 or 3 starts for a Mariners team that, you know, does profile as an average to above average team, you have to think that he's going to be in the mix for wins and really has a good opportunity to start things out against a swing and miss happy Astros lineup.
Yeah, I looked at it a few days ago. At the time, the Astros led all of baseball with a strikeout percentage above 25%. I think they were 2 percentage points ahead of the next closest team. So a pretty impressive start to the year in that regard for that Houston lineup. David Wright is not close to returning, according to manager Terry Collins. Wright will not be with the team when he's first eligible to come off the DL on Thursday. Probably looking at more of an early May return for Wright as opposed to something this coming weekend, which actually is part of early May. But I think first half of May is the general expectation for Wright. It's a hamstring injury. So, I mean, on the bright side, it's not a shoulder setback. And the shoulder was the major problem for Wright last year. But still, I do wonder if the cumulative effect of all the injuries he's dealt with over the last few years has chipped away at what was a pretty good player, very good player, even elite at his position for a few years. If Wright's new baseline is that of more of like an 18 to 20 home run guy who's not going to be able to run as much as he's now on the wrong side of 30.
I don't even know if 18 to 20 is a realistic marker. I mean, we saw him drop all the way to 8 last year, and I know health probably contributed to some of that demise, but he's 32 years old, so I don't know if we're necessarily going to see, you know, his skills appreciate. I think we're only going to see a decline from here in that regard. Contact skills, I think, are still good enough to make him a viable average third baseman, maybe even in the above average class. But I don't know if we can treat him as one of the stars at his position anymore.
I think you might be right about that. I mean, what's the difference? If Wright's not going to hit more than 15 home runs, what's the difference in his fantasy value versus Chase Headley's?
Not a whole lot. And, you know, we talked about the decline in homers. He's also been declining in stolen bases. Was previously, you know, a mid-double digits guy every year and then year out. Regressed to eight last year. Did have two stolen bases so far this year, but I'm just not confident that he's going to, you know, regain value in any one category at this point. He's going to be serviceable, certainly, but you probably expected a little bit more when you drafted David Wright than serviceable.
Also from the rehab folder, Hunter Pence, approximately 1 week away from taking batting practice on the field, still targeting a return at some point during May. But the one thing the Giants are doing that is sort of interesting is that they're looking at playing Brandon Beltmore in left field, giving Buster Posey more time at first base, and thus putting Andrew Susak in their lineup more frequently as the catcher. For me, that's kind of a win-win-win situation because, you know, Belt gets a little more positional flexibility. The Giants get, I think, an overall upgrade to their lineup because Susak is better than some of the options they're rolling out currently in left field. I mean, Susak versus Gregor Blanco, I'd rather just have Susak playing. And I like that it also limits the wear and tear on the legs of Buster Posey.
Yeah, I'm agreeing on all three of those scenarios just because I think the last part you mentioned is especially important, just making sure that Posey stays upright as best as you can because, you know, he's the engine that makes that team go. And really considering how big of a hole that they've dug themselves in, they really need to, you know, all hands on the deck to get their best offensive lineup available as possible. And I think Susak goes a long way towards achieving that because he is an upgrade over some of those other spare parts that the Giants could toss out there. Obviously doesn't have much of a major league track record just yet, but all the indicators suggest that he's going to be at least an average hitter at the catcher spot.
Yeah, it seems like that's a pretty good baseline and maybe even a top 10, top 12 type player on a per plate appearance basis. Again, looking among catchers, which certainly gives you some flexibility in a two-catcher league if the volume's going to be there. Once Pence returns, I wonder if that just means Nori Aoki gets squeezed a little bit or how they decide to handle it. I mean, Angel Pagan had such a difficult time staying healthy over the last few years. That question may answer itself. It may be a case where they don't have the luxury of choice. They may have to just go with the healthy trio in the outfield at that time. Josh Hamilton is officially a Ranger again. News first broke over the weekend that the Angels were going to part ways with Hamilton. They're trading him back to Texas. A player to be named later could be on the way to the Angels at some point, but most likely it's just going to be a deal where the Rangers are sending some cash to offset the cost of Hamilton. But for a player they didn't re-sign as a free agent a few years ago, they now get him back at a pretty steep discount. I've seen a lot of different numbers thrown out there. $5 million a year is one number that I've seen that makes some sense. I mean, for $5 million a year for 3 years, it's worth rolling the dice on Josh Hamilton. He's had a lot of success in Texas. And from a personal standpoint, he wants to be there, but I think just getting his life in order, it's easier to do that in a place that's familiar than in a place that isn't.
Absolutely. Really where the renaissance for his career took place was in Texas and in terms of his personal life as well. And you hope that he doesn't have any sort of substance abuse issues going forward, but you know, even if he relapses or doesn't get the amount of at-bats that, you know, the Rangers are probably expecting out of him, you have to like the deal just because of the upside that he carries. Even though, you know, we'll probably not see him return to those MVP days or anywhere close to that. Just in 2013, he hit 21 home runs and batted .250. That's not great production, but for a guy that you're rolling out there as a second or third outfielder, not a lot of teams, you know, have that at their disposal. So, considering the cheap discount that he's coming at and the power potential that he still carries, even, you know, as he's 33, 34 years old now, I think it's a great deal for the Rangers.
Yeah, Hamilton may turn 34 before he's actually on the field for the Rangers' birthday coming up in late May. But the question I've always had with Hamilton is just how much wear and tear has he put on himself as a result of his substance abuse? I mean, you just wonder, while he may only be 34 years old physically, may feel like he's 37, 38. I mean, it's just one of those things. You don't have any real comps to throw out there. You don't really know just where he's at physically. So that may have been part of the reason why the power dropped off as much as it did after his signing with the Angels. But getting back into a more hitter-friendly environment certainly can't hurt. And the Rangers have been reeling at the position really since Hamilton left. So I think this is going to be the best possible path for him to just get everything back in order and potentially to be a productive player again, even if it is at that 20 home run type level that you were referring to. The Marlins have designated Jared Saltalamacchia for assignment. Salty was gone on the paternity list for a few days, comes back today, gets DFA'd. He's in year two of a $21 million contract with the Marlins. Good news for JT Realmuto. I mean, this is going to make Realmuto a starter probably for 75-80% maybe of the Marlins games going forward. So if he's still available on the waiver wire, definitely worth a pickup. But are there any places where you see Salty as an upgrade over the team's current starter behind the plate?
I think Arizona makes a ton of sense for Saltalamacchia, even if the Marlins aren't able to work out a trade and end up just, you know, outrighting him off the 40-man roster. Salty has the option where he can decline that minor league assignment, and I think that that would be a wise thing to do just because you look at the Arizona depth chart. Tuffy Goswich, Jordan Pacheco are currently populating the top two spots. That's not a high bar to cross in order to win the starting job. Obviously, Salty has his flaws, strikes out a lot, doesn't really get on base at the clip that you'd like to see, but does have, you know, more pop than most of the other catching options out there. And if he's getting that every day at bats in a place like Arizona or anywhere else that, you know, might want to roster him, he'll have some value just because he's getting the regular at bats, so therefore he's got more opportunities to hit homers and drive in runs.
Yeah, I think alternatively, maybe you could see him end up as a backup on a team that has an aging starter. Maybe a team like the Phillies, if the cost ends up being league minimum, they can get Chooch a few days off here and there and just try to take advantage of Salty's power. But for the most part, there is a pretty short list. Arizona does seem like the best fit, as they've had trouble finding their primary catching option going back to spring training. I mean, there was a point where they thought Peter O'Brien was going to be that guy, and he's not even catching at AAA. So wouldn't surprise me at all to see Saltalamacchia end up with the Diamondbacks. Handful of players returning from injury on Monday night. Both Jose Bautista and Jose Reyes were back in for Toronto. Yadier Molina returned for the Cardinals. Corey Dickerson was in the lineup for the Rockies, and Jacoby Ellsbury rejoined the lineup after being held out with hip tightness on Sunday for the Yankees. Still in the day-to-day category, Jason Hayward banged up after leaving Sunday's game in Milwaukee with an apparent leg injury. Initially, it was an ankle injury, then I've seen groin, now I'm seeing hamstring. Not sure what specifically is the issue for Hayward. Kim Blame, after chasing down a triple from Gerardo Parra in that game against the Brewers. Gregory Polanco was a late scratch tonight. We'll see if there's any updates on him before we sign off. Rajai Davis is currently day-to-day, so we saw Anthony Gost get a start against the lefty, which is going to be very rare as you move forward with that Tigers lineup. And Devin Mesoraco, still day-to-day, just pinch hitting. That's all. They're just going to pinch hit him. I think it's now up to 15 games out of the starting lineup, three or four pinch hitting appearances since then. Well done, Reds. Well done.
Well, at least the opponents know that he's going to be available now. So now that Price has kind of taken the curtain away. But I think the one that kind of jumps out to me a little bit is the Rajai Davis injury. I know it's not viewed as, you know, a long-term injury just yet, but he had a huge weekend for the Tigers and got the start on Sunday, you know, despite a left-hander or a right-hander being on the mound. So it seemed like he was maybe encroaching on Anthony Goes' playing time in, as part of that platoon. So the injury setback will obviously take away that opportunity, and will probably have to, you know, prove himself again before he gets that opportunity to get the larger portion of the starts in center.
Yeah, I think with Goes, I mean, he had a really fast start. He's kind of tailed off a little bit since then, so it could be an ongoing battle. But the thing that always seems to hold true with Rajai Davis, no matter what team he is on, the last three or four seasons, regardless of the role he is projected to have, he finds a way to get playing time. And when he gets playing time, he gets you stolen bases. It's amazing that he's been able to do it year in and year out. But right now, he is day-to-day. RotoWire listeners are winning serious money at DraftKings.com. Baseball season is heating up. You, too, could be winning serious cash. You need to check out DraftKings.com, America's favorite one-day fantasy sports site. Use the promo code DVR when you deposit for a free contest entry today. Taking a look at some value picks for Tuesday's games. Anibal Sanchez, $7,700 on the road at Target Field facing the Twins for the second time this year. He stands out to me as a particularly good value. I mean, right now, until the Twins show otherwise, I think they might be the weakest lineup top to bottom. I think a team like Milwaukee, which has really struggled all year, still has the pieces in place to where they could snap out of it, especially once they start to get healthy. But I think when I look at the Twins, I don't really see a major turnaround coming from them as a group.
No, just a complete dearth of power, so much so that they've been relegated towards using a guy like Brian Dozier in the cleanup spot of late. Really need somebody like Oswaldo Arcia to really provide that boost. But him, Kennys Vargas, are both struggling right now. A lot of strikeout potential in that duo as well. So guy like Sanchez could take full advantage.
Looking at some hitters that I like, I mean, I would want to stack Rays against Chase Whitley. The Rays get a big park boost on the road at Yankee Stadium. You got a couple lefties you can mix in there, but as a group, you can get David DeJesus for $3,700. Steven Souza, pretty expensive at $4,900, but Asdrubal Cabrera, likely to hit third again, he's $3,900. Evan Longoria at $4,600, and James Loney at $4,100. So I think you can build a decent raise stack, take advantage of the favorable pitching matchup, but also the big park boost they get playing that game at Yankee Stadium on Tuesday. One question I had looking at the prices, Adam, do you trust Ubaldo Jimenez at $6,200? That is, of course, assuming that the O's and White Sox do play on Tuesday. Of course, things in Baltimore caused a postponement on Monday night, so there's some question as to how they're going to get that game in, given what's taken place there. But Ubaldo Jimenez has pitched very well to start the year, and at $6,200, it seems like DraftKings isn't really buying in on what he's done so far.
And I wasn't either, to be honest. I actually recommended him as a stack with the Blue Jays against him last week. And although he didn't really dominate them, he did hold them to only four runs over five innings. So he performed better against a very good lineup than I expected. I'm not sure if I'm a big believer just yet, but I do believe that he will, you know, outperform what he showed last season. I think that was kind of a worst case scenario for him. I'm not confident that he's going to be anything more than, you know, a useful number four, number five starter against weaker lines. But I think I'm going to stay away probably just yet and watch from afar. The White Sox do have some run scoring potential, and that's probably enough to make me leave him on the sidelines for this one.
Yeah, the White Sox are one of those lineups. They make me nervous. Even if they're running cold, I don't want to throw mid-level pitchers against them. And I mean, most of the time it's because they're at home at the Cell, in this case on the road at Camden Yards, also a very hitter friendly environment that could make that lineup very productive. You've got a pitcher that you like for tomorrow. Who do you like?
Yeah, I like Rafael Montero making his first start for the Mets against the Marlins on Tuesday. He's available for $6,500, and for that price I think he's great as that second pitcher spot in DraftKings that the DraftKings uses in their lineups. Maybe go with a pricier option for your first spot. Use a guy like Montero in the second spot. I know the Marlins have gotten off to a little bit of a nice start of late after a dismal start to the season. They swept the Nationals over the weekend, but we're held down by the Mets on Monday night and are still without one of their top hitters in Christian Yelich. And for that reason, I think that they are still a team that you can use kind of less than stellar pitchers or average guys like Montero against. Fourth worst strikeout rate in the majors right now at 23.1%. And they're also second in ground ball percentage at 50.9%. So that means they're not really putting the ball in the air. They're not doing a lot of damage with home runs, and they're whiffing a lot. So I think that could help Montero's ERA and whip in that respect in addition to those strikeouts. And really, if not for a 336 BABIP, I know that's probably a lot of D. Gordon influence in it, but I think the offensive results that we've seen from the Marlins would be even worse than they already are. So there is potential for this team to even regress to further from, you know, the low bar that they've already set. So I think that could happen on Tuesday, especially at a place like Marlins Park, which is ranked in the bottom five of the league in home runs allowed in each of the three seasons since it opened, and it's already 29th here in 2015. Really, aside from Giancarlo Stanton and maybe, you know, Marcell Ozuna when he runs into a good pitch, there's not a lot of home run threats in that lineup. And that's really one thing that's kind of doomed Montero over his young career. Doesn't keep the ball on the ground a lot, but, you know, with a Marlins lineup that's able to do that for him, I think And the fact that he's playing in favorable dimensions will allow him to escape the outing without too many black marks on his record.
And one of the key lefties in that lineup, Christian Yelich, currently sidelined with the bulging disc in his back. So I think that also works in Montero's favor. But I do like that this start is at Marlins Park. Let's talk about some box scores here from Monday night. The Jays and Red Sox kicked off a series. Pablo Sandoval actually left this game after the fifth inning with neck soreness. I think I've also seen whiplash being tossed around as one of the issues. He made a diving catch on the infield, hit the ground pretty hard. So he's considered day-to-day, potentially being evaluated for a concussion. Sandoval homered, I think, after that happened. It was kind of like the prototypical Pablo Sandoval in Boston home run that I expected. Just kind of hit a line drive of sorts that found its way over one of the short walls in right center field.
Yeah, I mean, you have to just be happy the fact that he left the game early. He was at least able to provide some value for people in daily leagues and those in weekly leagues that had him active. But definitely a situation to monitor heading into Tuesday. It seemed like John Farrell was pretty pessimistic that Sandoval will be available, but that's something that will be further articulated on Tuesday morning.
Bautista, as I mentioned earlier, returned for the Blue Jays 0-for-3 with a walk in this one. Edwin Encarnacion has been off to a slow start, too. He had another 0-for-4 night, down to 173 on the year. And the Jays as a team really haven't produced at anything close to the level I expected. They do have Michael Saunders back in the mix now. Russell Martin hasn't hit much. He had a 1-for-3 with a couple RBIs in this one. Devin Travis has been a really nice surprise, though. I mean, I expect him to be a good player long term. I had some questions as to what he might do this year. He went 2-for-4, homered off of Joe Kelly. He's now got 6 home runs on the season. I mean, Devin Travis locked to that 2 spot right now. We'll see if that holds up, but barring a prolonged slump and a resurgence from Russell Martin or possibly a fast start from Michael Saunders now that he's back, it seems like Travis has a chance to keep that role.
Yeah, I don't really see any reason why he'd be challenged for that with the way that he's hit so far. Really impressive what he's done when he wasn't really regarded as a guy that had a lot of pop coming into this season. But just in that kind of lineup, when you feel like a guy like Encarnacion or Bautista will heat up eventually, that's only going to further inflate those run scoring totals. I know right now he's right up there on the leaderboard with RBIs. I don't expect that to continue, especially if he's holding down, you know, a 1 or 2 spot in the lineup. But I think the runs is the one area where he can really take off.
I think you're definitely right about that. Team context still favorable, even though Bautista and Encarnacion have gotten off to those slow starts. Mookie Betts went 3-for-4 in this one, had a couple of runs scored. On the mound, Joe Kelly, 10 strikeouts, but gave up 5 runs on 5 hits over 6 innings. Aaron Sanchez had the start for Toronto, 7 Ks, 2 walks, 4 runs allowed, 3 were earned on 5 hits over 5 2/3. We were passing a GIF around the office. It was Aaron Sanchez throwing that 2-seam fastball. He throws it about 95 miles per hour as a starter. He throws a little harder out of the pen even. But he gets so much arm side run, it just looks like an inside out, like bending ball that has a ton of velocity, has some sink. I think he's one of those guys that while he's prone to being blown up as he figures it out, there's a good reason why the Blue Jays are giving him this prolonged opportunity as a starter. Because if they can get 180 innings from him this year instead of 70 as a reliever, even if it's more like 1.5-2 wins above replacement when it's all said and done this year, the long-term value is that he may be a frontline starter. He has the foundation if he can harness the command.
And I think fantasy owners are kind of the similar mind that you look at Sanchez's early results and you might be inclined to drop him if it was any other player. But when you see him pitch on the mound and some of the stuff that he can do, it just makes you want to hold on to him a little bit longer rather than giving up on him right away, just because you feel like when he puts it all together, it's going to be something special. But I'm thinking that eventually his destiny is going to be in the bullpen, just where he can kind of let loose and not have to worry about mixing pitches so much. But for right now, if he does, it looks like he is going to get the opportunity as a starter still. So really tough to let go of him, even though, you know, despite that nasty pitch that he had today, just another rather mediocre outing.
Yeah, it was. And things went sour for the Blue Jays in the late innings. Roberto Osuna gave up a run in this one. Miguel Castro ended up taking the loss, gave up a run on 3 hits in the bottom of the ninth inning. It was a non-save situation, a 5-5 tie, but the way Castro's been running the last few times out, I have to wonder if a change is on the horizon. Maybe Brett Cecil's going to get another crack as the closer. Ozuna maybe could be an option at some point. I think the Jays are a team that still look like one that could go out and acquire some help. Koji Uehara tossed a scoreless ninth when the game was tied. He ended up getting the win in relief. He's already got two wins after being slow to start the year with that hamstring injury. Royals and Indians in Cleveland, 6-2 in favor of the Royals for this one. Corey Kluber knocked around a little bit. Six runs allowed, four were earned on 10 hits. Struck out five and walked two, went six and a third. Jason Vargas gets the win. Walked five, only struck out one, but he was good enough to outpitch Kluber, so who saw that coming? Two runs on three hits over five innings. He improves to 2-1. Looking at the way this one went down, Mike Moustakas continues to amaze me. 4-for-5, had a couple of runs scored, drove in a run. He's now hitting .342 with a .419 OBP in the young season.
Yeah, really impressive. Really going back to the postseason has Moustakas been. So you have to like what you see from him on Monday night, but I'm not necessarily sold that he's completely figured things out. Had the tendency to go into prolonged slumps last year, and I think that something like that could happen again, but might as well reap the benefits while he's getting them for you. So good to see him thriving right now. Batted in the second hole in that lineup and will presumably stick there until he starts to cool off.
Jared Dyson had three steals in this one for the Royals. Had a couple of them, actually all of them off of Corey Kluber and Sal Perez. So a nice game for Dyson if you're using him for cheap speed. One thing that also stands out to me here, Jason Kipnis was leading off for Cleveland in this one. Michael Bourne hitting eighth. He went 1-for-4 in this game. Jose Ramirez continues to struggle at short, hitting .185 on the season. May not be far away from seeing Francisco Lindor in Cleveland. Definitely worth looking at him if you're in need of help in the middle infield in a deeper league. Nationals and Braves getting underway in Atlanta. Braves come away an 8-4 winner in this one, even though Freddie Freeman left early. He was ejected for arguing balls and strikes. He finished 2-for-3 before exiting. Yunel Escobar suffered an injury, believed to be a hand injury in this game. He left early as well, so could be some more issues on the infield for the Nats. Dan Uggla ended up replacing him. Looking at the pitching matchup, Eric Stultz, I never trust him, not even in a two-start week, not even in a very deep league. You have to be like a 12-team NL-only league where I'm desperate. He actually pitched pretty well in this one. Struck out three, walked three, gave up two runs on four hits over six and a third. Doug Fister got knocked around a little bit for Washington. Five runs allowed, four were earned, three Ks, two walks, 10 hits over five and two-thirds. The Nationals they've had injuries, for sure. I mean, to be totally fair as to what's happened to them so far, but 7-13, definitely not the start anybody was expecting from this club, even with guys like Rendon having not played a game yet, Worth coming back from a shoulder injury, Denard Span, you know, being limited earlier in the year, missing time following core muscle repair surgery. What do the Nats have to do? Is it just a matter of getting some of those guys completely healthy and getting Rendon back, or do they have more that they have to think about?
I think just getting healthy is going to be the most significant factor here, just because the guys that you're forced to turn to when in lieu of all those absences are pretty dire, really. There's just not a lot of depth on this roster. When you're counting on Dan Uggla for consistent at-bats or Danny Espinosa for consistent at-bats, that's a recipe for disaster. And simply by getting a guy like Rendon back, you just have to hope it's not a significant setback that, you know, he dealt with today. I think that'll just go a long way towards revitalizing this lineup and, you know, making sure that a guy like Denard Span gets settled back in after he missed multiple weeks with an injury of his own. Jason Worth has been slow out of the gate too. So I think those guys will heat up eventually. And even though, you know, the fantasy numbers aren't really off the charts right now for Bryce Harper, does have a .424 on base percentage, leads the league in walks, which I think speaks to his maturity as a hitter. I think that there still could be plenty good in store for Harper in terms of those counting stats too.
Agree with you there wholeheartedly. Nice to see him with that improved approach early on. The Yankees were 4-1 winners over the Rays. The production in this one came mostly from Brian McCann and Brett Gardner both going 2-for-4 in this one. McCann hitting his second home run of the season. Adam Warren pitched pretty well for the Yankees. Did not get a win. Struck out 6. Didn't walk a batter. Allowed 1 run on 5 hits over 5 2/3. Adelo Betances continues to pitch well. His velocity's been up his last few outings. Has now got 5 holds on the year, but Andrew Miller came on and picked up his 8th save. I would still look at this as an opportunity to still potentially buy low on Betances, because I think for many owners, there's some disappointment that he's not the guy. If Miller goes down with an injury, or if Miller hits a stretch where he struggles for a few outings, I could see this going back into that committee plan that Joe Girardi talked about throughout spring training.
And even if Miller is able to maintain that job, just look at what Wade Davis did last year. And I think that's a reasonable comparison of what to expect from Dellin Betances, even if he's just the 8th inning guy the rest of the way. Obviously, Wade Davis benefited from some wins, but the strikeouts per inning numbers were incredible. The ERA was obviously incredible. And Betances has all the ability to provide those that kind of production, as we saw last year.
Let's talk Mets and Marlins. This game, I think, was shorter than Caddyshack 2, which I refused to watch on principle. 1 hour and 58 minutes is all it took. Jared Cozart, Dylan G, both cruised in this one. G threw 70 pitches in 7 2/3. I don't know if I've ever seen a number that low over that many innings. Maybe like a Roy Halladay start or a Cliff Lee start or something. Just 1 run on 6 hits allowed for Dylan G. Struck out 3, didn't walk a batter. Jared Cozart cruised as well. 8 scoreless innings, 2 hits, 2 strikeouts, 3 walks, sitting with a 2.49 ERA on the season. But Steve Cishek gets blown up. Daniel Murphy hits a 3-run homer in the 9th. And Cishek has been one of those second-tier closers. Aside from not getting many opportunities, he's had a couple of meltdowns that have really put his owners in a bad spot in April.
And I'm frankly surprised that he didn't lose the job last year, because there was a similar stretch where he was just abysmal. And I think he could be one of the next shoes to drop on the closing front. I think the Toronto situation is probably a little bit more volatile than this one, just because Cishek does have a little bit longevity on his side that will allow him to stick on the roll a little bit longer. But if you're in a deep league, you might want to start prospecting for some of those Marlins middle relievers.
On the other side, Jeurys Familia came on, tossed a scoreless 9th, struck out 1. He now has 9 saves on the season. Who would have thought Jeurys Familia has been a source of stability? If you look back at last year, though, he did have better numbers than many people gave him credit for. I think there was some concerns that he might not be ready to handle the 9th inning role, but he's passed every test with flying colors to this point. But again, Daniel Murphy with that big home run. It's been a slow start for Murphy so far, hitting just 174. Maybe this will be the big game that gets him back on track, getting that 3-run home run in the 9th off of Steve Cishek. The Cubs were 4-0 winners over the Pirates at Wrigley Field. Jason Hamill pitched well in this one. He struck out 7, only gave up 4 hits over 8 scoreless innings. He picks up the win. Vance Worley took the loss for the Pirates, 4 runs on 9 hits over 6 innings. Chris Bryant continuing to contribute from the middle of the order, 2-for-4 with a couple of RBIs. Anthony Rizzo goes 2-for-3 with a couple of runs driven in. I mean, right now, Rizzo Bryant 1-2, maybe as feared as any duo in the league.
Yeah, Bryant still doesn't have a homer, but that hasn't nearly been, you know, an issue for the Cubs or for fantasy owners just yet, based on how well that he's been hitting. Getting on base at a 478 clip in his brief career so far, and I think I'm right there with you. I think those two are going to be the foundation for some great things over the next several seasons, and may already be the best, you know, 1-2 punch in the middle of the order of any lineup in the league.
I really like Dexter Fowler a lot too. I think I've talked about it a little bit on this podcast, and it was kind of an under the radar move. The Cubs needed to get some OBP infused in the top of their lineup. He's at 338 early on. I think he's actually going to finish the year with a mark above that. He picked up a stolen base in this one. He's now got 5 steals on the season. I mean, you think about a guy that now has Soler, Rizzo, Bryant hitting behind him. Starlin Castro's off to a nice start. His run scored count maybe could get up in the 90 range. I mean, I think Dexter Fowler might be one of those players that if you're dealing with injuries in your outfield, you're going out trying to make a trade for a player that can help you at least a little bit in every category, he's going to do that. I think power is something he's not going to give you a whole lot of. Maybe you get 10, 12 home runs from him over the course of the year. But I feel like the price in many leagues will be very limited, and you're not going to have to give up that much to acquire him in a trade.
Yeah, I don't think a lot of people realize just that he's even the leadoff hitter for the Cubs. I think When a lot of people look at the Cubs, they just look at the young talent that's pre-existing and just assume that those guys are kind of assuming the top spots in the order. But Fowler's pretty much been a consistent cog in that leadoff spot the whole year. Average isn't, you know, out of this world or anything, but certainly serviceable. And when you pair that with steals and the number of runs that he's going to get, a lot of value to be had at a pretty cheap price.
Currently, Tigers up 5-3 on the Twins. That game in the top of the eighth inning, David Price went 6 1/3 in this one, gave up 3 runs on 6 hits, struck out 7, and walked 2. He is currently in line for the victory. Actually, he's not. It's now because the Twins have 3. So he's how do we not get this right? I mean, you look at the way wins work. And I think a good example of this was yesterday in Milwaukee. I mean, the Brewers threw out a lousy lineup, managed to steal a game from the Cardinals. Mike Fiers goes 4, navigates through a lot of trouble, didn't pitch all that well, but he did just as much to leave them in a position to win as any other pitcher who appeared in that game. And because he didn't go 5, he didn't get the win. In this case, I still think Price should end up getting the win. It's just, it's not going to work that way, right? Like, the way this is going to shake out, because the Twins have got back to the point. Actually, I think he will get the win, just given the way the runs were scored in this game. I'm struggling with this, but nevertheless, I expected even more from David Price than what I got. Still 3 runs on 6 hits against the Twins right now is actually a lot for an elite pitcher to give up.
Yeah, I mean, it wasn't the dominant outing that people might have been counting on for him here. I'm sure he was a popular choice in daily options, just or in daily formats, just because of that favorable matchup at hand and pitcher-friendly park. But I'm not really sounding the alarm on him just yet. I'm pretty confident that he'll come around and kind of deliver on that draft day price eventually. And it's really the numbers aren't really that unsettling right now. 3.48 ERA. I mean, Kershaw's over 4 right now, I think, too. So I think natural order will restore itself eventually, and Price will kind of be that 5-category stud that everybody came to expect.
He should be in line for the win because the Tigers put up a 4 spot in the first inning before adding a 5th run in the second. So as long as the Twins don't get the late rally, David Price should end up with a victory. Jose Iglesias hit 2nd in this game, by the way. 3-for-4 so far. Hit his first home run of the season. He's been on fire to begin the year. He's got a .403 batting average. I look at him more as maybe a 270 guy with some speed who's going to hit in the bottom of the order. So I don't know if he's going to sustain anything close to this, but if you've been using him, congrats, because this is a level that I didn't expect him to sustain for even a couple of weeks.
And I think he actually had a similar stretch before he got traded to the Tigers a year ago, where he's just on fire for like a 2 or 3 week span with the Red Sox, and naturally regressed to, you know, hitting in the 250, 260 range as was kind of the expectation. So that being said, there is an opportunity to sell high right here. I think a lot of people will probably be onto that as well. So in that case, it might just be better to hang on to him. But if you do have somebody that, maybe not know the player pool or the player history as well, might be a prime opportunity to dump Iglesias while his value is really high right now. I don't think he'll bottom out completely. And I think hitting in that Tigers lineup will certainly, you know, help him in terms of runs scored. But right now, I don't think it's going to get much better than it is right now.
We got 1 minute of therapy coming up here. Reds 9-6 winners over the Brewers. Brewers were down 9-2 entering the ninth. They put up 4 runs, all of them charged to Burke Badenhop, who has just been a punching bag almost every time out to the mound this year. I have to wonder if there's an injury in play for Badenhop. But the Reds' bullpen is a disaster outside of Aroldis Chapman. But somehow, Jason Marquis goes 8. Gives up 2 runs on 7 hits, strikes out 3, and walks 2. If there's a silver lining for Brewers fans out there, Ryan Braun did appear as a pinch hitter, but he struck out. So, you know, maybe that's not great. At least he's playing. I mean, that's the key. At least he's playing. It was in the ninth. I think it probably came against Chapman. I got to look at the play-by-play log to be sure. Since Chapman had to come in, the Reds had a 7-run lead entering the ninth inning, and Aroldis Chapman still had to pitch. Like, that is not ideal in terms of keeping your best reliever fresh.
No, definitely not, and especially on a night where the Reds pretty much dominated throughout. But better to use him and finish things out than, you know, let a pretty poor Reds bullpen, besides Chapman, handle things. Haven't really proven capable in that regard this year. It seems like Brian Price kind of almost goes to Kevin Gregg in pressure situations by default for God knows what reason. But at least the Reds were able to secure the win and get back to almost 500 with the win tonight.
Well, I think it's just because Kevin Gregg is a man who's done that job before, and in the eyes of Brian Price, that is critically important. Braun did strike out against Aroldis Chapman, by the way, so I guess maybe not the most bleak thing ever, since Chapman strikes out a lot of guys. It's just part of what he does. Billy Hamilton in this one, just 1-for-5, hitting .229 on the season with a .299 on base, but still locked into that leadoff spot. Zach Cozart hitting second right now for the Reds, which seems dumb also, but everything that Brian Price does seems pretty dumb. How many F-bombs do you think he dropped when Badenhop was getting just lit up in the ninth inning?
All the F-bombs, I'm sure, just because of how much struggles that middle relief crew has had this year for the Reds. But able to secure the win, also contributing for the Reds in this one, was Todd Frazier. Reached base 4 times and was only credited with 1 at-bat. He walked 3 times. Also got hit by a pitch and was able to steal 2 bases and come around to score 3 times. So that's pretty much the ultimate productivity that you can have when you're only credited with 1 at-bat in a game.
Yeah, the Todd father contributing on the base paths again. One thing I noticed here, Gene Segura now has 7 errors on the season, trying to keep pace with Ian Desmond. I guess defense has been a problem for Segura this year. Jimmy Nelson had the start. It was ugly. 5 walks. Had a couple of wild pitches, as you'd expect. Command was all over the place. He didn't make it out of the third inning. Gave up 7 runs on 6 hits as part of the final line there. Boosted his season ERA all the way up to 4.03. So things just keep getting worse in Milwaukee. I mean, they have to get better eventually, right? It can't get much worse from here.
Yeah, they're 4-16. Trying to do the math, I'm sure that prorates out to around 30 or 40 wins, if that. Safe to say, I don't think that is probably going to be something that the Brewers are looking at, just given that they do have a few talented pieces that, you know, I don't know if they're going to realize their potential, but certainly not a team that's trying to bottom out right now. At least they weren't coming into the season, but pretty soon I think the next move is probably going to be to fire Ron Renicki, regardless of how much blame you want to assign to him for this start. I think that's just something that's inevitable at this point.
Yeah, I think when a team tailspins this badly, teams always do something. Whether you agree with it or not, they tend to make a move in situations that are this bad. The Phillies picked up a 4-1 win on the road in St. Louis. Cole Hamels took the ball for Philadelphia. He had 9 Ks. He walked 4, but stayed out of trouble. They gave up 1 run on 4 hits over 7 innings. His first win of the year. Jonathan Papelbon picked up the save. Ken Giles tossed a scoreless 8th inning. Still is not allowed an earned run this season. Most of the offensive production here coming from Odubel Herrera, who went 3-for-4 with an RBI. Ben Revere went 1-for-5 with a couple of runs driven in. John Lackey, only 1 strikeout for the Cards in this matchup, gave up 3 runs on 9 hits over 7 innings. Did enough to keep the Cards in it, but their offense really didn't do much. Yadier Molina, 0-for-4, his return to the lineup. And this is a team that had, again, they had to play without Jason Hayward on Monday night. Still day-to-day right now with Hayward, but Mark Reynolds in right field, less than ideal for a lot of reasons. He made a great catch in Sunday's game, though. I got to give him credit for that. Didn't expect him to even be in the outfield. He went from left to right in this one, went 0-for-3 with a couple of strikeouts. But usually a team that has a lot of depth. Right now, the Cardinals being tested, of course, Randall Grichuk being on the DL at a less than ideal time with the injuries they're dealing with in their outfield. But John Lackey, I don't know what's going on with him. He wasn't very good after the trade to St. Louis last year. I wonder if it might just be done. I mean, like at this point, maybe he's just kind of a veteran innings eater who's not going to help fantasy owners all that much. Just 14 strikeouts over 25 and two-thirds innings in his first 4 starts.
Yeah, like you said, the struggles stretch back to the trade deadline. So we're not just talking about a very small sample here to start the season. So really hard to get excited about what he's doing. At least he is generating ground balls at a good clip. Got 13 of them on Monday. Also got 13 in his last start. But, you know, for fantasy purposes, that really doesn't help you too much. He's been 5 or less strikeouts in 3 of his 4 starts this season.
Taking a look at a few of the late games here. Mariners on the road in Texas. Taiwan Walker pitching well so far, just allowing 1 unearned run on 6 hits over 7 innings. He struck out 5. And walked 1. On the Rangers side, Yovani Gallardo goes 6, gives up 3 runs on 3 hits. strikes out five, walks three. So a decent outing from Gallardo, but he is currently on the hook for the loss. That game in the top of the eighth as we get ready to sign off. Rockies and Diamondbacks at Chase Field. Rockies up 4-0 in the bottom of the fifth. All those runs so far have been charged to Chase Anderson. Tyler Matzek pitching reasonably well for the Rockies. Three walks, three hits, no runs allowed through four innings. Tyler Matzek, a guy I know he pitched well down the stretch last year, Adam. Do you like him as a road streaming option, or is he still someone that's hard to trust because he ends up going to some difficult places like Chase Field? And when he goes on the road to face the Dodgers, he's facing maybe the best lineup in baseball.
It's honestly the control that worries me more than the home park. It seemed like he kind of corrected those issues, which really dogged him throughout his minor league career. They kind of all of a sudden went away when he went to the major league rotation last year, really closed the season on a high note, but they've pretty much resurfaced in every outing that he's had so far this year. He had six walks in the previous outing before this, has three more tonight. So I think for that reason, I'm probably going to stay away from Matzek, even though he does have that sub-2 ERA as of now. Probably will get the win tonight if the results hold, but I'm going to need to see him exercise a little bit more command before I'm going to buy into him fully.
Dodgers currently up 1-0 on the Giants. Brett Anderson has tossed three scoreless innings. He's struck out three and walked one so far. Big-time Timmy Jim has the ball for the Giants. Looks like the Dodgers just plated their second run of the evening. No strikeouts yet for Lincecum. Already three walks, five hits allowed. Just a shell of the guy he used to be. It's sad. I liked it a lot better when Tim Lincecum was the Cy Young caliber pitcher he was a few years ago. Such an entertaining guy to watch, and now it's kind of sad, really.
Yeah, and I think we're at the point where you can't even trust him outside of San Francisco when he pitches. The home road splits are pretty dramatic with him, even in parks that skew neutral to pitcher heavy like Dodger Stadium. It's just he's a different pitcher there, or at any place that's not in San Francisco. And really, that makes him somebody that you can't really trust as anything other than a streaming option, or when he's got two starts lined up at San Francisco. Other than that, though, really tough to find a place for him in most leagues.
Looking here at the Astros-Padres box score, that game currently in the top of the fourth inning. Colin McHugh has allowed just one hit through three innings. He has five strikeouts. James Shields has pitched very well so far. One run on two hits. He's struck out eight through four innings. So 13 Ks over seven combined innings for Colin McHugh and James Shields. Jed Lowrie has gone deep for the Astros, his fourth of the season. George Springer has a stolen base in this game, and I only bring it up because he's gotten off to a really slow start. But that was one thing he didn't do last year after being called up. After flashing that 40-40 potential back in 2013, Springer was not very active on the base paths with the Astros. I know the hamstring injury last year may have had a lot to do with that. But even before he was hurt, he was not active initially. I look at him as a really nice buy low candidate right now. Tons of talent, still hitting in the heart of that order. I don't think things could get bad enough where they would send him down. Maybe that's possible. But the thing I really liked about Springer as I looked over his numbers from last year is that he was near the top of the leaderboard in terms of the average fly ball and home run distance. There's a ton of raw power in that bat. And he is capable of drawing some walks too, but very good sign that he's already got five steals now in the season.
And like Chris Carter and Evan Gattis, I think that he's going to go through those stretches where he's just striking out a ton and not getting on base at a high clip. But when the production's on, it's really going to be on hot and heavy. And the fact that he's already providing stolen bases is pretty enticing. And if he can just get the home runs to match it, which I think is definitely doable given what he showed last year, really a lot to like with the overall profile.
Immediately, I think of the John Germain episode of Seinfeld. You said hot and heavy, and makes me think of John Germain and Elaine, of course. Moving on to a couple of Twitter questions. These are from the mailbag. This one is from Matthew. How much playing time do you expect for Alex Guerrero? I think this has been a question that's bounced around in various platforms for the last couple of weeks. I mean, we're talking about a player who, in 24 trips to the plate this year, has five homers, 13 runs driven in. He's 11 for 22. He's hitting .500. With an OPS above 1,700.
I think now's the time where he's finally going to get the at-bats. What really helps his cause, I think, is Yasiel Puig's landing on the disabled list. Opens up a regular spot in the outfield. They're using Andre Ethier out there tonight, but Guerrero is getting the start at third. So really, you know, there's going to be a place for him, I think, regardless of where Don Mattingly chooses to slot him, whether that's third, left field, or at shortstop. I think we're going to start to see Guerrero get more at-bats. Might be the case where once he starts to cool down, and he probably will just because he can't possibly sustain this level of play, we might see more Juan Uribe just because he, you know, has a little bit more of a reliable glove at third base. Might see some of the other outfield options that they have there. Really, Scott Van Slyke's kind of a guy that gets lost in the shuffle. He's having a great year off the bench, too, in limited bats, but just too many pieces for this Dodgers lineup to really not have success with any combination that they roll out. I'm just worried about Guerrero getting, you know, enough at-bats to make him a viable play in shallower formats.
Yeah, I think 10 and 12-team mixers is still going to be hard to find a role for him, but at least maybe two or three starts a week in the short term with Puig down are an option. If he keeps hitting even at like a 280 clip with as much power, I mean, he's not going to show as much power as he has so far, but if he's a 280 guy on kind of like a 20 home run pace, they got to find a way to get him in there. So I think it really depends on your league, Matthew, but I think it's like a 14-team mixer or deeper, you can play him right now. Got to check where he's eligible too. Some leagues, he doesn't have that middle infield eligibility right now. He might be outfield only some places, may have picked up third base eligibility over the first few weeks of the season. One last question here in the mailbag. This one is from Michael. He wants to know, what do we think of Ruby De La Rosa in 12-team mixed leagues? Right-handed batters have been helpless against them so far. To drive that point home, De La Rosa is holding righties to a 204 batting average and a 235 OBP so far. But, of course, the problem is that lefties have feasted against them so far. Lefties are hitting 327 with a 647 slugging percentage. So what do you make of Ruby De La Rosa? Is he a streaming option in 12-team mixers right now, or is he something more?
I think the lefty-righty option is interesting, but I wouldn't necessarily put all that much weight into, you know, a month sample size, basically. He did fare better against right-handers last year, but it wasn't nearly as dramatic. I think just taking a look right here, the batting average was only 20 points higher against lefties only batted 20 points higher than they did than did righties. So tough to put too much stock in this early sample, but I do think because of the strikeout potential that he does have, he's a good option against teams that don't necessarily have, you know, a lineup that can really hurt you with fly balls. So in those instances, and, you know, especially places in the NL West like San Francisco or San Diego, where you can, you know, take advantage of the park effects if he's pitching there, I think he makes for a good play in those scenarios.
Yeah, there's a lot of talent there with Ruby De La Rosa. There always has been very good live arms. It's just a matter of harnessing everything and putting it together. I do like that the walk rate is down early on this year, just 1.8 walks per nine, 4.7% of the batters he's faced. If he holds that, we could be talking about a pretty big step forward. But in lineups that are more lefty-heavy, the slugging percentage from lefties last year was up above 470. I think it was around 410 against righties. So you got to be careful with certain matchups. As Adam said, at San Francisco, at San Diego could be fine. Even home against San Francisco right now, given the lineup they're throwing out there, he could probably get away with that because their left-handed bats aren't a lot of big boppers. So I think that could be a spot where you have some success. Probably a streaming option for now. If you have a deep bench, someone you do want to mix and match and stash away because there is a lot of talent there. If you have any questions you'd like us to answer in a future episode, some strategy questions, specific players, let us know. You can hit us up on Twitter at Derek Van Riper or at Wolfman Tweets. You can also email us at fantasybaseballpodcast@gmail.com. Thank you for listening to the RotoWire Fantasy Baseball Podcast powered by DraftKings.com. And again, if you listen to us on iTunes or Stitcher, you can please rate and review the podcast. We're really appreciative of any and all feedback that we get. Adam and Clay will be back with you tomorrow.